From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! IMF and World Bank chiefs tour Africa to promote their agenda. We'll speak with the Archbishop of South Africa, as well as grassroots activists from Uganda and Kenya. We'll also speak with a representative of the World Bank. And the last message. Today we bring you part two of one of Malcolm X's final speeches before he was assassinated 36 years ago. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former President Clinton disclosed that two felons to whom he granted clemency on his last day in office paid large legal fees to his brother-in-law. Clinton said he told Hugh Rodham, brother of former First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, to return the money to the felons. The amount of money was not immediately disclosed, but CNN reported it was a total of about $400,000. One of two congressional committees already investigating Clinton pardons, particularly the one he gave to fugitive billionaire Mark Rich, promptly announced plans to examine the transactions. Not to belabor the point, but Native American leader Leonard Peltier, who's remained in prison now for 25 years, did not hire relatives of Clinton to plead for executive clemency. The United States yesterday urged Israel to release millions of dollars in taxes due to the Palestinian Authority, ignoring an Israeli demand that violence must first come to an end. The UN representative to the Palestinian Authority, Terje Rode Larsen, made the same appeal and said it would be very difficult to stop the violence as long as Israel restricts economic activity in Gaza and the West Bank. He said that the Palestinian Authority is on the verge of collapse because it will not have the money to pay civil servants and its security forces. Rode Larsen explained that the Israelis were holding $54 million in tax funds they collect from Palestinians and on Palestinian-made products. The economy has declined sharply since violence broke out last September because Israel prevents Palestinians from commuting to their jobs in Israel. Rode Larsen said the closure policy, which is the main cause of misery in Gaza and the West Bank, is colossally counterproductive to any security interests, including and most particularly Israeli security interests. Most of the bombs dropped by U.S. warplanes on Iraqi radar stations during last week's airstrikes missed their mark, said Pentagon officials, with most of the misses blamed on a new and expensive Navy-guided bomb. A Navy official said about 25 of the guided bombs, which were first used in combat 2 years ago, were dropped in the attack, and the majority fell, quote, tens of yards with their targets, from their targets. Another official said he had been told the bombs missed by an average of more than 100 yards. Pentagon officials' assessment of Friday's airstrikes against the Iraqi anti-aircraft system, which involved U.S. and British warplanes, was initially glowing. But the disclosure of the guided weapons failure rate stunned defense officials yesterday and led them to scale back their assessment of the damage done in the attack. This news from Lebanon. Security forces used water cannons and batons to drive back hundreds of students marching on the American embassy yesterday, protesting the bombing of Iraq and U.S. support for Israel. Officials said at least 12 people were injured. About 500 students tried to march on the fortified compound, but were met by about 200 helmeted riot police swinging batons and backed by rifle-toting army troops atop armored personnel carriers. Large banners denounced Israeli Prime Minister-elect Ariel Sharon and President Bush as, quote, two faces of the same terroristic coin. The Security Council and Congo's warring sides have agreed to a new timetable for the factions to begin pulling back their troops and for UN observers to move in to oversee their departure. A resolution with the new blueprint is expected to be adopted today at the conclusion of a two-day meeting between the Council, ministers of the six warring countries, and representatives of Congo's three main rebel groups involved in the conflict. Hopes for peace have been raised by recent pledges by Rwanda and Uganda to withdraw troops from Congolese territory. In addition, Congo's new president, Joseph Kabila, has agreed to meet with a regional mediator to launch talks with the country's internal opposition, a key provision of the 1999 ceasefire agreement that his slain father had refused to fulfill. The Supreme Court has ruled 5-4 that state workers cannot file employment discrimination suits against their employers under the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. The court's majority held that Congress went beyond its authority when it let state workers file such claims. The case decided yesterday concerns two suits brought against Alabama by employees accusing state agencies of discrimination because of medical problems, breast cancer in the case of Patricia Garrett, and respiratory ailments in the case of Milton Ash.
Because of the empowerment zone, because of what the people are doing here, because they've made me feel so welcome here today, and because this is what my presidency was about, and it's a lot of what I want to do in my post-presidential years, bringing economic opportunity to people in places who don't have it, here at home and around the world, and bringing people of different races and religions and backgrounds together. This is what this means to me. I feel wonderful about it, and I'm very, very grateful.
President Clinton speaking just a few days ago about his choice to move to Harlem, his office there, as he talked about devoting his life to empowering people here and around the world. Though many have characterized his presidency differently when it comes to other countries. And today we're going to talk about international monetary institutions like the IMF and the World Bank and their approach specifically to Africa. World Bank President James Wolfensohn and IMF Managing Director Horst Köhler are currently touring Africa starting today and continuing through Saturday. They're meeting with numerous African heads of state in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Earlier this week, the IMF and bank heads officials met with 12 heads of state in Mali. The tour is a follow-up to the IMF and World Bank commitment at the Prague 2000 annual meetings to put Africa at the center of their institutions' activities. According to an IMF press release, the trip will focus on the need to reduce poverty through sustained economic growth, to combat AIDS, strengthen governance, improve the investment climate, and resolve conflicts. The public relations statement went on to say that the heads of the IMF and World Bank are anxious to listen to how African leaders plan to address these issues and to discuss how the institutions can best support them in their efforts. But critics charge that the World Bank and IMF came to Africa not to listen but to instruct, not to support indigenous efforts to ameliorate socioeconomic distress, but to promote interests of the industrialized nations that set the agenda at the world's top financial institutions. We're joined right now by a number of people to talk about the World Bank IMF initiative right now in Africa. And we're going to begin with the Archbishop of South Africa. We're joined by Archbishop Njonga Kula Indungane, Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa, successor to Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning and welcome.
It's good to have you with us. You now are in Atlanta, Georgia. What does South Africa want from the IMF or the World Bank, or does it want anything to do with it at all?
I think that we need to look at this in this broad context. I think South Africa is part of the continent of Africa, which is a big continent, and part of the most debilitating programs have actually affected the rest of the continent in terms of the developing world. And we from Jubilee 2000 are saying that the World Bank and the IMF have actually strangled development in Africa through its structural development programs, which insist, among other things, that the first call of a nation's budget should be the repayment of debts.
We're also joined on the phone by a representative of the World Bank. The World Bank, again, right now leading a second summit after the earlier summit in Mali, now in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Pamela Cox is with us, director of the Africa region for the World Bank. What is the point of this tour of the IMF and World Bank heads?
Well, thank you for inviting us to join in this conversation, and I'm sorry you couldn't reach Mr. Wolfensohn directly in Africa. The point of these meetings, which is a historic visit because it's both the fund and the bank together, is really to listen to African leaders, to listen what African leaders want from the bank and the fund, and to incorporate that into our programs. And I think, as you noted in your introduction, we've had, on several other occasions, had meetings with heads of state in Kampala and Dakar and Libreville, and very much the information and the discussions coming out of these meetings led to such things as a support for the HIPC initiative, support for capacity building, support for a sharper focus on poverty reduction.
We're joined also on the phone by Jokey Jehu, director of the 50 Years is Enough Network, which has led the move to critique the bank. She is in London right now following closely what's going on with the World Bank IMF tour. Your major concern right now, and the protests have been going on now for a number of years against World Bank IMF-led development. What is the major point of your critique?
I think that our major point and really where we come at this is looking at what civil society that was in Bamako, Mali, mostly outside the meetings protesting, are saying about the role of the World Bank and the IMF in Africa. A very strong statement from the Tanzania Agenda Networking Program. And as a U.S. network, our position has always been to amplify the positions that are coming from our colleagues in the South. And in Mali, they talked about the role of the World Bank and the IMF in exacerbating rather than in reducing poverty in Africa. And we would agree with them that structural adjustment programs, including things and other programs, including things like the HIPC initiative, that they've not really been for the benefit of Africans and the continent, African peoples and African countries, but maintaining an economic system that uses and employs African peoples and resources and does not, for the most part, benefit them. When we look at the statement from the Tanzania Gender Networking Program, we share their outrage and concern that the heads of the World Bank and the IMF are meeting with Tanzanian civil society for a one-hour session on the very last day of their visit in Dar es Salaam. So I feel like a broken record. You know, there's nothing new here. This is, for the most part, a public relations tour that is intended to smooth the way for development in Africa, World Bank IMF style. There have been many African initiatives, including the OAU-led African Alternative to Structural Adjustment Programs that is now going on to be 6-8 years old, that was never implemented. It's not like there haven't been initiatives and ideas from Africa. I don't know. I am a lot more skeptical about this tour across Africa. There are new gestures and certainly new things like meeting these regional summits, but I'm not convinced that they're going to be doing anything different. The bank is, in fact, beginning to expand their structural adjustment lending, continuing, whereas the call has been for them to stop structural adjustment, imposing structural adjustment programs, and they're looking to expand their structural adjustment lending. So I'm a lot more cynical and a lot more critical than perhaps the World Bank and the IMF expect people to be in looking at this tour of the heads of their institutions.
Pamela Cox, your response to Jokey Jehu. Pamela Cox, Director of Africa Region for the World Bank.
We very much appreciate the views of civil society, both at the local level in our programs and then globally in discussing these very important issues. We believe that there are many initiatives on the table that are directly benefiting Africa right now. HIPC is for the benefit of Africa. $25 billion of assistance is coming through HIPC this year, which we think is a major improvement. In addition, there are many issues in the global economy now that we're talking about. How do we start looking at the global architecture? For example, trade access. If Africa had maintained its share in world trade, it would be earning an extra $66 billion a year. This is an issue that we've heard from African leaders that they would like the World Bank to be an advocate of in various fora, and I think we want to move ahead on that as well. In terms of looking at our programs, in response to discussions with civil society and, of course, with our shareholders and at annual meetings, we're focusing now on the poverty reduction strategy papers, which are initiatives led by governments focusing very clearly on their plans for reducing poverty in their own countries. And we at the World Bank would then come in and design our programs to support these initiatives, which are designed by countries and led by countries. We're moving away, actually, from structural adjustment lending to supporting these poverty reduction strategy papers. And again, I want to emphasize we very much support development led by Africans, led by the African countries. One of the things that Mr. Wolfensohn and Mr. Kohler will be talking about with Presidents Mbeki and Bouteflika and Obasanjo is this new Millennium Action Plan, this so-called Marshall Plan for Africa. And they sat down with these three presidents in Bamako and said, what can the bank and the fund do to help? What can we do to support you? So I think very much we're working to support what Africans themselves want for development.
Could I come in here?
Yes.
Could I come in here?
Yes, Archbishop Ndugane.
I think that one of the fundamental things that the World Bank and the IMF should do, rather than going up and down Africa, is to cancel the debts, period. Because this whole issue, I mean, Jeffrey Sachs says the World Bank and the IMF are masters of deceit. If you look at the case of Mozambique, for instance, even after Cologne, little more debt was relieved. Mozambique spends more on debt servicing than on health and education, even after the massive floods that hit Mozambique that we all know about. The World Bank and the IMF refused to cancel any further debt, but instead simply offered new loans and extended the terms of repayment. In other words, it's not working towards improving the condition of the people. It's extending imprisonment or slavery of people in terms of debt. One thing that they should do is to cancel the debt. And with respect, I think that the World Bank should engage with organs of civil society who are making these proposals for a better life for the people in the developing world.
I would also like to add that, the representative from the World Bank talked about the HIPC initiative. It was actually someone from the World Bank about 10 days ago, just in London, talked about that. Basically, the HIPC initiative has been about releasing 60 cents to the dollar for the multilateral institutions, for the World Bank and the IMF and creditors, and only 40 cents go to the country. So, I mean, the HIPC initiative is flawed, and it's a deeply flawed system that divides some countries from, countries between those that deserve, quote-unquote, debt relief and those that don't deserve. And even within the HIPC classification, it doesn't include countries that are heavily indebted, such as Haiti. If Haiti is not a heavily indebted poor country, or a country like Nigeria, I don't know what we are talking about. and the PRSP. I mean, again, our colleagues in Tanzania, and I know that the other people on the phone who can talk about this, having been involved in it in sort of in the first line, that it is a process, again, coming from the World Bank and the IMF, designed from outside and imposed on Africa and the global south, and that the poverty reduction strategy process that it includes, it gives the World Bank and the IMF virtual veto power. Yes, people sit around across Africa, in Kenya, in Tanzania, in Uganda, and other places talking about the poverty reduction strategy papers, but the World Bank and the IMF have veto power.
Well, Jokey Jehu, I want to ask Pamela Cox of the World Bank about that issue raised by the Archbishop of South Africa. Of why not just cancel the debt? But we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and that question goes to the World Bank. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we have this discussion at the time where the presidents of the World Bank and the IMF are touring through Africa, starting today in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, just came from a meeting of heads of state in Mali. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We are talking about the World Bank and IMF, the relationship to Africa, as World Bank President James Wolfensohn, IMF Managing Director Horst Köhler are currently in Africa, now in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Just came from a meeting with 12 heads of state in Mali. And we're on the telephone with the Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa, Archbishop Ndungane. We're also joined by Jokey Jehu of the 50 Years Enough campaign. She is originally from Kenya, speaking to us from London right now. And Pamela Cox is on the line with us, Director of Africa Region for the World Bank. Pamela Cox, what about the Archbishop's call for simply a cancellation of the debt?
Well, first of all, we have to talk about who holds the debt. When we started the HIPC initiative, the debt that was outstanding to the World Bank was less than 10% of all the debt for the heavily indebted countries. So first of all, we have to emphasize that the debt problem is not simply a problem of debt to the World Bank.
And when you say HIPC, that stands for?
For the Highly Indebted Poor Countries Initiative. This is the initiative sponsored by the World Bank and the IMF to reduce the debt for the highly indebted poor countries. And those would be countries whose debt repayments would exceed 175% of their GDP. But when we started with the HIPC initiative, only 10% of the debt was due to the bank. In fact, a large amount of this debt was due to bilateral creditors, which may either have been commercial debt or it may have been debt, especially in Africa, to official or government lending agencies. So in the HIPC initiative, we work to reduce all this debt, and we're very glad to see that our bilateral partners have, in many instances, cut this debt. In the case of the bank, it's not so simple, because in the case of IDA, which is our soft loan window, this is simply a fund that the bilateral countries pay into. We have no reserves to pay off the debt. And in fact, after the year 2005, we're relying on the other governments to actually help IDA pay off this debt. In the case of IBRD, our loss reserves have already been used to underpin the risk of the loans on our books. For the IBRD, which is the World Bank, the borrowing side, we actually go out to world markets and borrow the money we lend, like most banks do. So we need to have these reserve ratios, in fact, to borrow money. And I'd like to also emphasize that it's not possible just to take IBRD's reserves. This would have a huge impact on the countries who take IBRD loans, who, in fact, are home to 80% of the world's poorest people.
Archbishop Ndungane, does this satisfy you, this response
of
the World
Bank? No, it doesn't. To some extent, Pamela is right. But, you see, we talk about multilateral and bilateral debts. But the fundamental principle position of Jubilee 2000 is that these debts have been paid twice or thrice over. And the second thing is that they are unpayable debt. And an unpayable debt is an unpayable debt, period. And in national domestic law, we have got bankruptcy laws. In international law, we don't. I think that what the World Bank should be doing, instead of going to talk to the leaders in Africa, they should be talking to their bosses, the creditors of the North, and say that, look, if we want to improve the condition of the people in the developing world, if we're serious about addressing the conditions of abject poverty, as it has been said that by 2015 we want to cancel half the debt that's being owed abject poverty by 2015. I think the first step is the cancellation of the debt. They should be organizing that. They should be following on the pledges that have already been made by countries that have talked about 100% debt cancellation. In other words, these debts are unpayable. And it's useless trying to be cajoling leaders who feel entrapped and enslaved by the whole international economic system and to buy into this thing. So our proposal is that the World Bank and the IMF should, instead of talking to leaders in the developing world, they should be addressing the G8 countries and making them follow up their pledges of 100% debt relief, canceling the multilateral and bilateral debts.
Pamela Cox of World Bank.
I'd like to assure the Archbishop that indeed we are doing this. We bring this up in fora. Our president brings this up every time he meets a head of state. And in fact, we're very grateful to Jubilee 2000 because we also feel that they've put this issue on the map, particularly for parliaments and congresses who need to vote this money for debt relief. So, in fact, we agree entirely with the bishop. We are doing this. We're organizing. We're following up. But I do want to emphasize that the World Bank can't do this by itself, that we need the other governments to agree to vote this money in their Congress to write off these debts. So we appreciate very much what civil society is doing to bring this issue to the forefront.
I wanted to bring Algracia Akwe into the discussion, who is the Deputy Country Director of Action Aid in Uganda. Can you talk about IMF World Bank-led development and its effect on women in Uganda?
Thank you very much for bringing me into this. I've been listening, and I would like to agree with the Archbishop and the others that the impact of this is tremendous, especially on women. And in the context of Uganda, the health and education sectors have been the most hit in that we have a huge number of people, for example, who are living with AIDS, HIV/AIDS, and the access to drugs is and other services in this area have been tremendously difficult, with introduction of user fees also for common ailments like malaria. And you find now that malaria itself is beginning to be a killer disease. So in terms of impact on the poor, I think the situation is worse than it was. And we're beginning to see the whole process of the PRSPs probably as another form of conditionality. It should offer some hope, but it's not giving us this hope. One, the process of developing the PRSPs itself, the timing does not really allow for that kind of participation of the poor in the process, because there seem to be some hurry in getting these PRSPs done, and then the process of approval. It is of some concern to us that PRSPs which should be the plan of a country, have to be endorsed by the IFS, World Bank, and IMF before we can even benefit from the relief or the debt relief that is supposed to be due to us. And this raises a question of transparency in negotiations. We get a feeling that there's some lack of transparency from the World Bank, that in one hand, the PRSP process is supposed to create some way of participation of the poor in the process. But we also feel that the real key issues and the procedures and the whole capacity of governments and people to engage with the World Bank is not there, and therefore there's still lack of transparency in all this process.
What about this charge of secrecy, Pamela Cox of the World Bank?
I'd like to emphasize that the World Bank does want to work very closely with people at the ground level. We do want to emphasize that the PRSP is not...
And PRSP, again, stands
for... Poverty Reduction Strategy Paper, which is a government-led initiative. Various governments do it in very different ways. And, in fact, we try to help governments to expand the participation and the voices of the poor in this process.
But what about the issue of secrecy that Graciacque was talking about, the concerns about board of directors, executive directors of the bank meetings being kept secret, the lack of working the people at the grassroots level understanding what is going on because of the lack of transparency?
Okay, I think there's two issues here. One is what sorts of documents and transparency and so on that we have. And these documents are all available both in the countries where we have offices that provide them and, of course, over the Internet for those who have that ability. I think the second point is that the bank...
Let me just get a response to that, because I know this is a major concern of grassroots groups all over. Archbishop of Cape Town.
If my information is right about this poverty reduction strategy, it is linked to user fees. That is, poor people having to pay for fees for health and for water. And the statistics are that in Kenya, for instance, where this was introduced, there was a 52% reduction in outpatient visits in Kenya's health centers once these fees were applied. And in Malawi, there was an increase of primary school enrollment from 1.9 million to 2.9 million. Once school fees and uniform requirements were abandoned. And I am told that even in my country, in South Africa, this user fee introduction has resulted in taps being closed in KwaZulu-Natal because poor people couldn't pay for water, and hence the cholera that ensued, and we're having to pay billions and billions of rands to deal with that. So even that kind of program has its flaws.
I'd like to emphasize here that the poverty reduction strategy papers do not advocate user fees, nor does the bank insist and promote user fees. In the case of Kenya, for example, there is no poverty reduction strategy paper that's been done to date. So I think it's very difficult to link these sorts of issues to PRSPs. We would like to point out that these issues of user fees are very, very complex. We do not promote user fees in the World Bank. However, we understand in many countries that where there are not the resources, there's not the taxing ability, countries do ask for user fees, as in the case of South Africa. And we work with governments to make sure that the poor are not adversely affected by these sorts of things.
Joking.
In fact,
I would like to respond because I think that there are a couple of issues. Yeah, the issue of transparency, there are lots of documents that are not available to civil society. And the PRSP in Tanzania, Ms. Cox, I would like you to take a look at it, look at the policy metrics, look at the interim PRSP document. It did include, they're not called user fees, they're called community financing, they're called different things, cost sharing, but they're included in there. And let me say that when you say that a lot of documents are available on the website, I think the producer of Democracy Now! Can attest to the difficulty of even just getting through on the phone. Many countries, electricity is being rationed. You know, before it happened in California, it was happening all over the global south. Getting to the web is not a viable option for the majority of people in the global south. And even if they were to be able to get there, those documents are in English. They are not available. Accessibility is not just being on the web. They are not available for people to understand if they are in a foreign language. And in terms of documents that are available to the people, forget the ones that are on the web, documents such as the Community Action Programs, CAPS, which is a new initiative under which structural adjustment lending is to continue, the Public Expenditure Reform Credit. These are new initiatives, quote-unquote new initiatives by the World Bank, but they're really structural adjustment lending that are supposed to, and I'm quoting here, enhance participation and decentralization. They are block grants to communities and local governments. And the Public Expenditure Reform Credit is about reform of legal and judicial reform, anti-corruption efforts, and editing. But the documents that are associated to those two initiatives are not publicly disclosed. So it's like you get a blindfold on your face, and then you're told, go out there and do what you need to do. When you don't have the ideas, you don't have the information that drives these initiatives, it is, you know, unfortunately, really irresponsible of the World Bank to be moving in this direction. I feel like the
World Bank... Well, let's get a comment from Pamela Cox.
Right, let me just say one last thing, that I feel like the World Bank treats Africans as children, African civil society like children. You know, things like HIV, AIDS, and poverty reduction, yeah, we can get information on this, but the fundamental framework that drives some of the issues that are tied to trade liberalization, that are tied to privatization and debt, we should not have any knowledge about that. We should not have any input. You can't have it both ways.
Pamela Cox.
Well, I'm unclear exactly of the criticism here. First of all, there aren't a great deal of documents in general on public sector reform credits. This is something that's very new, is being talked about, is being discussed. Uganda is one of the first ones we're looking at. I know the team has met with a wide variety of people. So the question of the idea that there are documents circulating around that aren't accessible is simply not true. In the case of the CAPS or the community assistance programs, we're also already doing many of these programs. These are essentially social funds and getting funds down to the community level for local groups to use. And it's difficult for me to understand how these are being linked to structural adjustment because they're essentially social funds. I do want to emphasize we very much want to continue to work with civil society and to discuss and debate these issues. It is very difficult for us, as it is for any organization, to get every document that anybody wants translated into every language. We certainly would want to work with local groups that would want to facilitate this. It's difficult for us to get down to these grassroots, and we very much depend on working with these groups. So what I suggest is in these countries, let's figure out ways to get this information out better. We're here, and we're willing to listen on how to do this.
Oh, Gracie Akwe of Uganda, ActionAid.
I just wanted to, to clarify the dilemma here. We have structural adjustment programs still ongoing. That has never changed. Now, our understanding of PRSPs is really to reduce poverty in the sectors that have been most hit because of structural adjustment programs that are ongoing. Now, that's where the participation of the civil society and poor people is expected to be. But the essential basic relationship between our government and the IMF and World Bank is the SAP agreement, all that negotiation with the SAP agreement, which we did not participate in as civil society or local people or poor people, that has not really changed. So on one hand, the trade agreements and the SAP agreements that have been negotiated adversely, you know, negate the possible relief that we could get from any debt relief. And that's where we feel that the negotiation, even the capacity of ourselves to engage with the World Bank or with IMF is really practically not there. Do we have a choice? We don't really have that kind of choice to decide, because unless our PRSPs are approved by the World Bank or by the IMF, then we don't really get access to debt relief either.
Archbishop Ndugane, we're going to end with you.
Yes, I think that we have a fundamental issue at stake here, that these instruments service the interests of the creditor nations of the North, and there's a call for the transformation of these institutions because the world has changed from the time these Bretton Woods institutions were created. And so there needs to be a sharpening of minds and finding some creative and innovative ways of leveling the playing field because there's an even development in this whole issue that if the countries of the North and the countries of the South could be treated and deal with this as equal partners, and therefore needing to sit back and work on what kind of international instruments we need in this changing, globalizing world.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Just a continued discussion here on the issue of globalization and particularly World Bank IMF-led development, as the heads of the World Bank and IMF are this week in Africa, holding a major summit on Tuesday in Mali and now in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. That does it for this part of the conversation. Archbishop Ndugane from Cape Town, South Africa, successor to Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Thank you for being with us. Also on the line with us from London, Jokey Jehu, director of 50 Years is Enough Network, Algracia Akwe, Uganda deputy country director of Action Aid, and Pamela Cox, director of Africa Region for the World Bank. And if you want to see the contacts for the different groups' information, you can go to webactive.com. That's www.webactive.com, where you can listen to Democracy Now! And you can also get all the contact information. When we come back, the second part of the last message. 36 years ago, Malcolm X was assassinated. This is one of his last speeches. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
I'm Danny Glover. Democracy Now! Means exactly that, that it is demand. It's demand that we hear the truth. It's demand that we be full participants in a system that is life-affirming. It means it is a demand that we be full participants in a system which takes the present and the past and the future and places within our grasp.
On the 36th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, actor and activist Danny Glover hosted a celebration last night of Malcolm X's life at the City College of New York. Last night's event marked the launch of a major fundraising campaign to support the purchase of a permanent home for the Malcolm X Museum. But the museum wouldn't be limited to one space. Building on the idea of using Harlem's public spaces as its collective memory, a number of public sites that were significant in Malcolm's life will be recognized and developed, where so much of his organizing efforts took place, sites such as the Audubon Memorial, the mosque at 116th Street, and the new outdoor plaza at 110th Street, among others, would be incorporated. Among those honored last night was a longtime activist, Yuri Kochiyama, whose parents were forcibly interned along with 120,000 other Japanese Americans during World War II. She was a close friend of Malcolm X, lived in Harlem for decades, and held him in her arms as he lay dying on February 21, 1965, at the Audubon Ballroom. She has moved back to Northern California, but sent this message by videotape.
February 21st, 1965, the day that Malcolm was killed. That day when we went to the Audubon Ballroom where the meetings are held, for some reason, everybody felt something was going to happen. And we even heard that Malcolm, when he had come, seemed a little bit disconcerted. He told his bodyguards not to be armed at all because he didn't want to frighten women or children. None of the speakers who were supposed to speak that day showed. When Malcolm was introduced and he came on, two black men jumped up and one said, "Get your hands out of my pocket." And everybody looked in that direction. And there was no one protecting Malcolm when shots rang out. Soon as we turned back to the stage, we saw that Malcolm was hit and he went straight back and fell, and all hell broke loose. People were running, all the chairs had crashed to the floor. Just then, a young brother came by who seemed to know how to get to the stage, and I followed this young brother to the stage and went right to where Malcolm is, and I just put Malcolm's head on my lap. He was having difficulty breathing, and he never said a word. But Malcolm, I don't think, will ever die. What he stood for, his visions of a fairer world, his spirit will live on forever.
Yuri Kochiyama, longtime activist, friend of Malcolm X, now near 80, living in Northern California, one of the three people who were honored last night by the Malcolm X Museum campaign, as Malcolm X Museum is being established by the City College, a part of the City University of New York. And we'll end today's program with the second part of one of the last speeches that Malcolm X gave. It was a day after his home was firebombed. It was just before he was assassinated 36 years ago. Malcolm X.
I also have been taught in Islam that one God who only has one religion, and that religion is called Islam, and all of the prophets who came forth taught that religion. Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, all of them. And by believing in one God and one religion and all of the prophets, it creates unity. There's no room for argument, no need for us to be arguing with each other. And also in that religion, of the real religion of Islam. And when I was in the Black Muslim movement, they didn't have the real religion of Islam in that movement. It was something else. But the real religion of Islam doesn't teach anyone to judge another human being by the color of his skin. The yardstick that is used by the Muslim to measure another man is not the man's color, but the man's deeds, the man's conscious behavior, the man's intentions. And when you use that as a standard of measurement or judgment, you never go wrong. But when you just judge a man because of the color of his skin, then you're committing a crime, because that's the worst kind of judgment. If you judge him just because he was a Jew, that's not as bad as judging him because he's black, because a Jew can hide his religion. He can say he's something else, and which a lot of them do that. They say they're something else. But the black man can't hide. When they start indicting us because of our color, that means we're indicted before we're born. which is the worst kind of crime that can be committed. And the Muslim religion has eliminated all tendencies to judge a man according to the color of his skin, but rather the judgment is based upon his deeds. And when, prior to going to into the Muslim world, Elijah Muhammad had taught us that the white man could not enter into Mecca in Arabia, and all of us who followed him, we believed it. And he said the reason he couldn't enter was because he's white and inherently evil, and it's impossible to change him. And the only thing that would change him is Islam, and he can't accept Islam because by nature he's evil. And therefore, by not being able to accept Islam and become a Muslim, he could never enter Mecca. And this is how he taught us. And, you know, and so when I got over there and went to Mecca and saw these people who blonde and blue-eyed and pale-skinned and all those things, I said, well, but I watched them closely, and I noticed that there was, though they were white, and they would call themselves white, there was a difference between them and the white one over here. And that basic difference was this. In Asia or the Arab world or in Africa, where the Muslims are, if you find one who says he's white, all he's doing is using an adjective which to describe something that's incidental about him, one of his incidental characteristics. So there's nothing else to it. He's just white. But when you get the white man over here in America and he says he's white, he means something else. You can listen to the sound of his voice when he says he's white. He means he's boss. That's right. That's what white means in this language. You know the expression free, white, and 21. He made that up. He's letting you know all of them mean the same. White means free, boss. He's up there. So that when he says he's white, he has a little different sound in his voice. And I know you know what I'm talking about. This was what I saw was missing in the Muslim world. If they said they were white, it was incidental. White, black, brown, red, yellow. It doesn't make any difference what color you are. And so this was the religion that I had accepted and had gone there to get a better knowledge of it. But despite the fact that I saw that Islam was a religion of brotherhood, I also had to face reality. And when I got back into this American society, I'm not in a society that practices brotherhood. I'm in a society that might preach it on Sunday, but they don't practice it on any day. And so since I could see that America itself is a society where there is no brotherhood, and that this society is controlled primarily by racists and segregationists, and it is, who are in Washington, D.C., in positions of power, and from Washington, D.C., they exercise the same forms of brutal oppression against dark-skinned people in South and North Vietnam, or in the Congo, or in Cuba, or in any other place on this earth where they're trying to exploit and oppress. This is a society whose government doesn't hesitate to inflict the most brutal form of punishment and oppression upon dark-skinned people all over the world. To wit, right now, what's going on in and around Saigon and Hanoi and in the Congo and in elsewhere. They are violent when their interests are at stake. But that, with all of that violence that they display at the international level, when you and I want just a little bit of freedom, we're supposed to be nonviolent. They're violent. They're violent in Korea. They're violent in Germany. They're violent in the South Pacific. They're violent in Cuba. They're violent wherever they go. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be nonviolent. That's a shame, because we get tricked into being nonviolent. And when somebody stands up and talks like I just did, they say, well, he's advocating violence. Isn't that what they say? Every time you pick up your newspaper, you hear where one of these things has written into it that I'm advocating violence. And I have never advocated any violence. I've only said that black people, who are the victims of organized violence perpetrated upon us by the Klan, the Citizens Council, and many other forms, we should defend ourselves. And when I say that we should defend ourselves against the violence of others, they use their press skillfully to make the world think that I'm calling on violence, period. And I wouldn't call on anybody to be violent without a cause. But I think the black man in this country, above and beyond people all over the world, will be more justified when he stands up and starts to protect himself, no matter how many necks he has to break and heads he has to crack. I saw in the paper where they, on the television, where they took this black woman down in Selma, Alabama, and knocked her right down on the ground, dragging her down the street. You saw it. You're trying to pretend like you didn't see it because you knew you should have done something about it and didn't. It showed the sheriff and his henchmen throwing this black woman on the ground. On the ground. And Negro men standing around, doing nothing about it, saying, well, let's overcome them with our capacity to love. What kind of phrase is that? Overcome them with our capacity to love. And then it disgraces the rest of us because all over the world, the picture is flashed, showing a black woman with some white brutes with their knees on her, holding her down, and black, full-grown black men standing around watching it. Why, you are lucky they let you stay on Earth, much less stay in the country. When I saw it, I dispatched a wire to Rockwell. Rockwell was one of the agitators down there. Rockwell, this Lincoln Rockwell. And the wire said, in essence, that this is to warn him that I am no longer held in check from fighting white supremacists by Elijah Muhammad's separatist black Muslim movement. And that if Rockwell's presence in Alabama causes harm to come to Dr. King or any other black person in Alabama who's doing nothing other than trying to enjoy their rights, then Rockwell and his Ku Klux Klan friends would be met with maximum retaliation from those of us who are not handcuffed by this nonviolent philosophy. And I haven't heard from Rockwell since. And brothers and sisters, if you and I would just realize that once we learn to talk the language that they understand, they will then get the point. You can never reach a man if you don't speak his language. If a man speaks the language of brute force, you can't come to him with peace. Why, good night. He'll break you in two, as he has been doing all along. If a man speaks French, you can't speak to him in German. If he speaks Swahili, you can't communicate with him in Chinese. You have to find out, what does this man speak? And once you know his language, learn how to speak his language. And he'll get the point. There'll be some dialogue, some communication, and some understanding will be developed. And you've been in this country long enough to know the language the Klan speaks. They only know one language. And what you and I have to start doing in 1965, I mean, that's what you have to do, because most of us already been doing it.
Malcolm X, one of the last speeches he gave before he was assassinated February 21st, 1965. He was speaking in Detroit, Michigan. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can write to us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!